Tech Talk. Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Thanks to Think. From digital signage to audiovisual solutions, we've thought of everything. Visit thinkpm.ie.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Tech Talk. Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up this week, we'll hear about the use of AR, VR and 3D in operating theatres in Ireland. Emporia, the smartphone brand aimed at older people, will chat through their new device to help the visually impaired. Plus, the country manager of Emirates joins me to discuss how technology is helping them to resume some form of normality. As always, you can email the show techtalk@newstalk.com or you'll find me on Twitter at JessKellyNT. And there really is only one place we could start this week, and that is with the ransomware attack on the HSC. As I've been saying right throughout the week here on News Talk, this isn't going to wrap up anytime soon. The impact of this attack is going to be felt for some time. On Thursday, a decryption key was handed over by the hackers. This essentially could help the HSC repair some of the damage done by this attack. But before it's used and fully deployed, the IT specialists need to verify that it is legitimate and that it doesn't contain any further malware. Some people throughout the week were asking why the hackers would do this. Surely they don't all have hearts of gold. And the answer is, we don't really know. I heard Paul Dwyer on News Talk Breakfast saying that it could be that the hackers were facing pressure from others in their community to decrypt the files, because I suppose targeting a health service during a pandemic is not a good look. Others are saying that it's a chess move to show maybe a gesture of goodwill that may entice the HSE to pay the ransom to prevent the data from being uploaded online. It's a very tough one to read. This entire situation is a bit of a chess match. If you've wondered or questioned during the week, you know, why aren't we paying the ransom? It goes back to what Ronan Murphy said on this programme last week. If you opt to pay, you are kind of opening yourself up to setting up a precedent in this regard. Other hackers may say, well, look, Ireland has paid before, let's target them again. There's also no guarantee that if we do pay the ransom, the data would not end up on the dark web. So it's not, I don't see a win-win situation here, to be completely honest. It is a very tricky situation to manage. If you are worried about your data, there are some things to keep in mind over the coming days. Firstly, it's important that we know, obviously, this is a massive attack. It's had a massive impact. But these types of things happen every day of the week around the world. Data breaches happen. Information is uploaded online. That's why we have those scam calls, those phishing attempts and so on. This does happen quite often. I would encourage you to take some time over the next few days to ensure all of your accounts have two-factor authentication in place. If this data set that the hackers have access to is uploaded to the dark web, it's fair to assume that we will see a rise in phishing attacks and scams. So just do what you can to get your ducks in a row. The two-factor authentication, it may not be bulletproof, it may not prevent you from being targeted, but it will help you identify if you are. You will see little notifications if somebody does attempt to get into your account, that sort of thing. If you are concerned that some of your data may be online, if you see any of your data as a result of this attack, you're being encouraged to contact the Gardaí and the HSC. We need to stay very vigilant at the moment, and I would say always, when it comes to online activity. Don't click on any links that you're not sure of. Don't pass on any misinformation via WhatsApp or other means. Go to trusted news outlets for your information. If you get a call from someone purporting to be a bank or a GP or another service provider, do your best to verify that they are who they say they are. If you can't, just say you call them back and call the number that you usually use to get in touch with that service provider. If it is legitimate, work away. If you're unsure, just walk away. No service provider will mind you taking an extra few minutes to verify the authenticity of calls, texts, emails, any form of communication, particularly at the moment when fears are slightly heightened. It's also worth keeping in mind and sharing with your friends and your family members. Very few organizations ask for financial information over the phone or via email. Don't hand over any details unless you are 100% sure that it is legitimate. As I say, these attacks do happen, and there is very little that we can do right now to stop it and to prevent our data from getting into the hands of cyber criminals. Be vigilant is the best advice I can give you. TechTalk@newstalk.com is the email address if you want to share your thoughts on the attack, how it's being handled, the fallout, which, as I say, will continue to occur for some time to come. Now, earlier this week, I spoke to Chris Millington, who's the MD of Emporia in the UK and Ireland. Emporia is the company behind a number of devices aimed at older people. I recently reviewed one of the devices on the Pat Kenny Show and was very impressed. But I spoke to Chris this week about their new phone, which is looking to cater to those who are visually impaired. Before we talked about the devices, I started by asking him to tell me a little bit more about the company's background.
Yeah, absolutely. So Emporia is an organization that's been around 30 years this year, just been our 30th birthday, actually. And the original founder and now sole owner of the business, Evelyn, always had the mission of trying to help older generation with technology, but simplified technology. So not simple, not dumbed down, but making things so easy to use and providing support for customers that have specific needs, maybe with some sight issues, with some hearing loss, with some dexterity issues that happen to us all as we age. A focus on those areas to help people use technology and be able to enjoy technology in a much better way.
You mentioned there that the company is now 30 years old. Can you talk us through some of the challenges, but also the opportunities that have been there for Emporia to ensure that older generation is not left behind?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big question in the world today is how do we encourage people to adopt technology and use technology in their life so that they can have more freedom, more connection, more use of the technology in their life to do the things that they're going to need to do? And, gone are the days where you can choose not to have technology because all of the institutions, all of the things that we do require it. For instance, track and trace need you to use a smartphone. Banking now, with the closure of so many branches around the world, and you're seeing a lot of that with banks closing in the Republic now, you're starting to see that people have less physical access to facilities, and they're going to have to start using digital access instead. So the last 10 years has taught us a great deal. We're not on our own in trying to resolve these things, but we have to take our view. And we've learned an awful lot in those 10 years. And part of that is to provide really amazing training guides. And we wanted to do training one-to-one to start off with. And we've been doing that, we were doing that in Austria and Germany with professional trainers, with real face-to-face training of groups of 10 older users to show them how technology can improve their life, can give them some really new areas to enjoy. And then, of course, the world of COVID changes all of that, so you can't meet people face-to-face anymore. Now, luckily, we'd already developed a training book to go with our smartphones, and that seems to be the huge change that's enabled us to reach a new audience. So as lockdown happened, we were in a really fortunate situation where our smartphones come with a book that's 153 pages, it is now, on the latest version. And whilst that might sound daunting, it's not meant to be that way. It's a book that you can always refer back to. It's there to take you on a journey with the product. So if you're not used to a smartphone or used to touchscreen technology, it will help you and introduce you to that kind of technology for the first time. But if you are a user today And you were a smartphone user 5-6 years ago before you became, say, for instance, 70 years old and retired and enjoying life a little bit more in different ways, then because technology changes, you may need a book to refer back to. You may need something to refresh your memory because you're not using it every minute of every day. And that's an interesting thing that we've found in our studies as well, that usage of the younger generation can be 4 to 4.5 hours of a device per day. Probably doesn't surprise you in the slightest because you're one of those younger generation. But as we age, when we get 50 plus, that drops down to about 2 hours a day. And when we retire, it drops down to 15 minutes a day. So it's not that we get old and can't remember how to do things. It's that we're using things far less, so it's much more difficult for us to recall how to use functions. And if a mobile phone company changes the way the software works and moves things around, then we have to learn it all over again, and that can be confusing when we're in retirement.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. One of the things I often talk about here on Tech Talk is that we have to be very careful that as tech continues to develop, we don't leave people behind, whether that is because of their age, education, financial situation. Obviously, some of these devices are quite expensive. We need to bring people with us. Otherwise, we're going to have segregations in society, which is obviously not good on any level. One thing I am very interested in, though, is, you know, if you sit in on any marketing presentation or if you do any research in terms of where the money is within the tech sector, it tends to be in a very particular demographic from, you know, 15-year-olds to 45-year-olds, let's say. They're the ones who spend the money. They're the ones who want the latest iPhone or Samsung or whatever it is. I'm curious, from a business point of view, you are going after a very specific niche market. It's that older demographic who, as you mentioned, may only be using their smartphone for 15 minutes a day. Talk us through a little bit about the business model and the business side of things.
So technology for a younger generation, when the usage is so much higher, can evolve and can change at pace. So I mentioned retirement's a really important part of our focus. When you retire, things change. You know, you spend all of your life saving up for this moment of retirement, so you build up this fund, and you've got an income at the same time to run your everyday life costs. And then you retire and you no longer have an income and you start spending all of those savings. So whilst this is the wealthiest group of all the groups on the planet, you know, they've got more savings and more financial wealth than anything else, to try and understand how they see value and perceive technology and its role in life is a really important element of understanding how you deliver a product and a solution to them. So expecting somebody to go out and spend £1,000 on an Apple iPhone is completely unrealistic when they're now on a pension that they've saved all their life for, because they have a different value perspective. They are going to use a phone less. Now, 15 minutes is the current usage of somebody who retires and perhaps hasn't engaged with technology, but it's an average. So there'll be some people with much less and some people with more. Not everybody's the same. What is clear, though, is because the usage falls, maybe there's a problem in the way that technology doesn't deliver that value for them. So that's what we're all about, is focusing on how we deliver value, how we deliver products that really make a difference to someone's life, that can encourage them to do more things. Now, in Ireland, there are over 700,000 people over the age of 65. And our research shows us that only 36% of the adult population in the UK and Ireland own a smartphone. So the business case is that there's 500,000 people in Ireland that don't own a smartphone that could really benefit from using a smartphone in their life. Now, some of those group are going to be older and resist having a smartphone, so you could reduce it a little bit further, say that we discount everybody over the age of 90, for instance, because they're less likely to buy a mobile phone that's a smartphone, you're still looking at 400,000 people that are addressable to this kind of device. And then you've got people that obviously are blind, have sight loss, hearing loss, and these guys need some extra additional support. They're not going to deal with just a smartphone. So for us, it's niches within niches, but really it's about understanding the age group, understanding what their requirements are, understanding how to communicate correctly with the group, how to reach them. And it's all about enabling people to do more because they're not stupid. You don't suddenly lose the ability to use tech when you're 70 that you could use 5 years before when you were working. You just need a bit more support to remind you where things are because you're going to use it less. And if you, there's loads of studies on the way the human brain absorbs information and repetitive actions. You need to repeat something more than 1 hour a day to have complete recall on how to do those things. But if your habits change because you're going to spend more time in the garden, or you're going to spend more time, hopefully when the world changes, traveling and seeing your family, then you are going to use tech less and it's going to not be there for you to recall immediately. So you need a bit more support. So the science is there. And from an economic perspective, it's a really lovely market to be involved in because there's not many players in it. You can do something different and really help people. So actually the value that we get is not just a monetary value. You know, we're really changing people's lives. It's wonderful to do.
You mentioned there about people who may be blind and maybe partially sighted, that they have very specific requirements. I know that the NCBI is now selling an Emporia device. Tell us a bit more about that and the considerations that went into producing something like this product.
Yeah, so building a device that... So I'll try and rewind, actually. So I tried in a previous role in another company that looked after this age group to build a device for the blind some years ago. I got some really strong relationships with the RNIB in the UK and obviously NCB in Ireland. And it's a fascinating area when you get involved with this particular group of users. And whilst not all of them are older, the vast majority of sight loss does happen in later life. And then if you've not got access to technology earlier, and you've not been an adopter of, say, some of the accessibility features that are on an iPhone, then you're really going to struggle with communication as you age. It's a difficult thing to get people to utilize. So I couldn't help but build a device, and I use those relationships with the RNIB and NCBI to make sure that we delivered a product that was really focused on somebody with sight loss, and deliver a solution that was really good value as well. Because there are solutions out there, mainly software on smartphones, but they're so expensive, it's incredible. So I took a phone that I knew I could build a software for to make it accessible, completely accessible. And we made it talk with the help of using Google's voice technology, which is outstanding. And it's quite amazing, actually. It reads the screen ever so well. So it'll read back the menus. It'll read you who's in your phone book. It'll tell you who's calling you. And of course, it reads your text messages as they come in and reads them out to you before you send them out. And all the keys talk as well. It's astonishing. But when you work with people like the RNIB and NCBI, you learn little tiny things like, how do they know what the battery status is? And nobody's really ever thought of these things because we're not blind. So we've had to build in additional features so that you can press a button on the side of the phone when it's closed, because it's a clamshell. And it will tell you the time of day, and it will tell you what the battery level is. Loads of little tiny things that you'd never think of. So you need NCBIs and RNIBs to help you in this journey. It's really clever.
Yeah, it's very clever. As I said, it's great to see the markets that you're tackling and you're addressing with the Emporia smartphones. The first phone we spoke about, which is there for older people, is available from OnPost Mobile. And the talking phone for those who are partially sighted or blind is available from the NCBI. Chris from Emporia, thank you so much for your time.
It's an absolute pleasure. Anytime.
Coming up next, the country manager of Emirates talks about how tech is helping to get passengers from A to B safely.
Tech Talk. On News Talk.
Thanks to Think. From digital signage to audiovisual solutions, we've thought of everything. Visit thinkpm.ie.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. TechTalk@newstalk.com is the email address if you would like to get in touch, or you'll find me on Twitter @JessKellyNT. We know that the travel industry has been severely impacted by COVID-19 over the last 14 months. And we're now going to chat with the country manager of Emirates Ireland, Enda Corneille, about how tech is helping to get passengers back in the sky safely. Enda, you're very welcome to the show. You might just start by telling us how the year has been for Emirates.
Well, the COVID-19 virus has had a really fundamental effect on the business. I suppose the main thing have been a series of public health restrictions on travel across all of our markets. And then to the extent of countries actually closing their borders. If you take Ireland, for example, we would have flown 14 flights a week. We now fly 3 flights a week. And major markets like Australia and Thailand, South Africa are closed to us. So a very fundamental effect on the business.
Well, making the decisions to reduce the number of flights, I mean, how did you settle on 3? And what were the different considerations that you had to sort of bear in mind as you made that call?
Well, we actually suspended all operations on the 25th of March of last year. And we came back then with 2 flights a week, which were purely cargo. And about a month later, then we began to carry passengers. So we were at 4 flights a week for some time. But the recent mandatory hotel quarantine process has really hit our demand even further. So we've reduced now back down to 3. Our ambition now would be to get back to a daily operation, certainly by the end of the year. But the situation is very fluid, very uncertain.
You're using a lot of technology and you've embraced a lot of technology. I know that your planes have always been sort of at the forefront of the tech side of things, but you're embracing a new element of digitization to try and get passengers back on planes in a safe manner in respect of COVID-19. You might talk us through some of the innovations that you're trying out at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, the aviation sector has always been a fast adopter of very sophisticated technologies, aircraft design, engines. Emirates have really utilized this sort of technology to empower customers, allowing them to tailor and almost co-create their travel and in-flight experience. COVID has accelerated this. I mean, for example, when you check in now in Dubai, all of our bag drop kiosks and check-in kiosks had now gone touchless, so it can be controlled completely by your personal device. When you get on board the aircraft, again, you can use the app on your device to look at the menu. It's all digital. You can create your playlist from our in-flight system of 4,500 channels. Again, sync that then with the system when you're on board. And it's all really, I suppose, designed to keep people safe, give people confidence to travel with Emirates.
How quick a turnaround has this been in terms of getting from the, we're cutting all of our, we're on hold, to let's start looking at ways to get people flying again?
Well, we're always, I mean, Emirates is an airline. I've been working with them for 7 years now, and they strike me as an airline who always wake up every morning wondering what more we can do for the customer. So while some of our team were working on schedules and could we fly and could we not fly, a whole other group of people were worrying about, well, how can we make it safe for our customers in terms of technology? So a lot of work was going on to our website, going on to the app. We've 20 million downloads now on our app in 19 languages. And it was all really designed towards moving things very, very quickly so that we could show customers how safe it was to fly with Emirates. I mean, one of the major, technological advances we've made has been to link up with IATA, the International Air Transport Association. and were one of the first airlines to trial the IATA travel pass, which curiously was invented by an Irishman working for IATA. But this is really replacing the old yellow card some of us would have carried, detailing what vaccinations you had traveling to places like Africa and so on. So this new digital passport will allow customers to, I suppose, verify their pre-travel test or vaccinations, that they meet the requirements of the destination they're going to, and then share that with authorities on or airlines at check-in. So a lot of work has gone in here, and it's already been trialed in Dubai. It's being trialed in Singapore at the moment. And I think this is really the future and something that will stay with us for some time as we move out of COVID.
And is that all done through your app so that customers don't have to have seven different types of paperwork and digital verifications when they're going through the airport?
Yeah, it's actually an IATA app. That it's a digital passport based on one single app, and that then feeds information from test centres and vaccination centres in. It allows the customer to personalise all of their travel documents in the one place on their device. And then critically, when they go to travel, it can transmit that information using QR codes into check-in systems, into immigration systems. So it really, everything is there in your hand. And as I said, I think this is really exciting. This is really the future. And it really removes the requirement to carry multiple pieces of paper, and obviously avoids fraud, avoids people losing things as well.
What's going to be the approach towards people who don't get the vaccine?
I think it's very unclear. I mean, this will be largely governed by countries and by public health authorities. I mean, airlines like Emirates will adhere to whatever rules are in place and work with them. I think we are probably moving to a point where, and you see this with the EU green certificate, if you like, that there will be a benefit for those traveling who are vaccinated. And obviously, alternate arrangements will have to be in place, and that may require quarantine, etc., for those who are not vaccinated. But I think in the next probably 4 or 5 weeks, 6 weeks, we'll know a little bit more about this. But even then, the EU Green Cert is a good first step. But until, you know, internationally, governments around the world adopt these kind of standards, you're really not going to see an effective return to flying globally. It may be just confined to some markets, such as Europe.
In terms of the planes itself, like back in 2019, good old 2019, I would have travelled quite a bit, and I'd always go online and research the seat and see how much space I'd have and be very careful in my seat selection. Are we going to see more of that now? And is there any thought or conversation around redesigning the economy section of planes to give people more space?
Well, I think certainly in 2018, Emirates introduced 3D seat models on using virtual reality technology. This is based on our digital platform. So it really enables the customer to go on board and virtually explore the seat, look at the cabin, see where they want to sit. I mean, the seat pitch is very generous on Emirates in every class, whether it's economy, business or first. Certainly at the moment, there's no issue whatsoever because so few people are flying. I don't think it's a case that we'll certainly look at reducing the seat count, but all the time we're looking to how we can make things more comfortable. And I suppose adding in the ability for customers to be more empowered, and I mentioned digital menus, syncing, using your personal device rather than using the screen for your in-flight entertainment, and all of that is going to continue, I think, into the future.
A lot of the flights that Emirates host are obviously longer distance. This isn't just a 30 or 40 minute flight to the UK. What about staff procedures and training and sort of cleaning etiquette, all that sort of stuff? Is that going to be revamped?
Well, that's already been revamped. I mean, that was one of the, again, when I mentioned, giving the example of all the various teams, like there was a huge amount of work done with our crew. All of our crew wear full PPE. Every passenger on board receives a little kit with mask and sanitizer and gloves. Now we've been able to evolve that over the period of the last year. So the food service now is very much back to normal. But all the time, you know, the HEPA air filters used on our Boeing 777 A380 aircraft are hospital standard. All of the air in the cabin is changed every 2 minutes, completely changed. So all of those method, all of those measures, if you get, will continue. And, you know, we are working on further ones to continue to make the aircraft as safe as possible and to give people confidence to travel.
I know you don't have a crystal ball, but what is your projection in terms of getting back to a more sustainable level of travel from a business point of view? Do you have sort of a time frame in mind as to when that might happen?
It's very difficult to say. I think this year will be interesting. I think our sense is that demand for air travel certainly exists and people really want to get away. But in terms of getting back to normal, I think we'll see normal booking activity coming in quarter three, quarter four of this year, and really normal flying activity being next year. Yes, there will be some holiday traffic towards the end of the year, but in terms of, you know, a full year where Dublin Airport and other airports are at full tilt, you're into 2022 and 2023, but you ask any airline manager, they'll give you a different date. Very, very difficult to predict it accurately.
But you do envisage technology playing a big role in terms of, from the second a passenger arrives at Dublin Airport until they get to their destination, the role of the phone and the different applications that we're all going to become very familiar with, that will be the key to unlocking travel again.
I think it's one of the major parts of it. And I think a lot of these developments, which I suppose essentially were brought out because of COVID, they're going to be sticky. I mean, contactless check-in, using your own device on board, all of those things, I think, will be with us. And it's how airlines like Emirates can further develop them and make them attractive and, I suppose, give them a new value beyond COVID. But I think certainly empowering that customer to co-create their own experience, I think that's here to stay. And I think airlines will be competing with themselves, with each other, to see who can do it best. For Emirates, you know, we wake up every day trying to see what we can do more, and we're already working on allowing customers, you know, to as I said, to use their personal devices rather than even use our screen on the in-flight entertainment. So a lot of things coming down the track, and I think while they may have been driven essentially by COVID, I think they're going to stick with us for a long time.
Enda Corneill, Country Manager of Emirates Ireland, thank you so much for your time. Coming up next here on News Talk, we'll hear how AR and 3D is being used in operating theatres.
Tech Talk on News Talk.
Thanks to Think. From digital signage to audiovisual solutions, we've thought of everything. Visit thinkpm.ie.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's Tech Talk. You can email the show at any stage, techtalk@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Twitter at JessKellyNT. Ruth Delaney is a consultant orthopaedic surgeon who carried out Ireland's first shoulder replacement surgery using 3D blueprinting and virtual reality. And I'm delighted to say that she joins me now. Ruth, welcome to the show. Can you talk us through just some of the innovation that has crossed your desk recently?
So I'm a shoulder surgeon. My practice is entirely focused on shoulder surgeries. And one of the main areas that we have had a lot of advancement in recently is in the area of shoulder replacement surgery. A lot of people have heard of hip and knee replacements and maybe are not as familiar that we have also shoulder joint replacements. And in recent years, our ability to understand the shoulder with arthritis that needs replacing has advanced hugely because of advances in CT scanning and 3D CT. So the patient has a CAT scan before their operation, and we now have software. Over about the past, I would say, 8 years, we have planning software that allows us to break that down. The software is something called Blueprint, and it uses automated segmentation of the CT scan. So it generates 3D images of that patient's shoulder, that individual shoulder, and exactly what way it is worn and what things we're going to have to deal with when we go to do the replacement. And so we've been using that for quite some time, but it also gives us a springboard to then get into even more improved accuracy in terms of how we implant the shoulder replacement for each individual patient. The first thing that Blueprint allowed us to do was plan exactly how we put the component of the shoulder replacement into the socket of the shoulder. And that's usually the most difficult part of the shoulder replacement. And based on that CT planning, Blueprint can then allow for 3D printing of what we call a patient-specific instrumentation or PSI guide. So that in the operating theater, that guide will be sterilized and it's individual and unique to that patient. And we put that on that patient's shoulder socket when we get to that part of the operation. And that allows us then to place the pin that we use to guide the whole implantation very accurately based on the software planning, which has been based on analyzing an infinite number of points in that patient's bone. So it's much better than we could ever do on our own without the software, which was basically sort of eyeballing it. And that was okay when we had nothing better. But now we have all of this technology that allows us to be more accurate. And the theory is that that should then translate into better long-term outcomes for our replacement patients.
That's incredible. And to think that it's this type of technology that we've probably heard a lot about, you know, things like, VR, 3D, we've heard a lot about it in different settings. But when it comes to the medical arena, it's great to hear that it can help you, the surgeon, the doctor, to do your job that bit more accurately, perhaps efficiently, and then also have better patient outcomes. Do you have a guide in terms of, you know, what the benefits are? And by that, I mean, in terms of, you know, the time, the accuracy, the aftercare, is it a noticeable, markable, measurable difference between the old way versus the new way?
Well, certainly if you take the old way as being just with a basic 2D CT scan and the surgeon making some manual measurements and then kind of, you know, eyeballing it as best as possible in surgery versus using the planning, it saves time in the operation because there's less doubt as to where exactly things should go. There's less trial and error. It's essentially trial without error. You do all your trialing on the computer, on the software before you get to the operating theater. So it saves time. It makes things more efficient. You know exactly which implants you're going to use before you get to the operating theater. So you can tell the staff in theater and the rep from the company who's bringing the implants, I need this, this, and this for this case, rather than I'm not sure yet, I need you to bring everything. So that has implications in terms of efficiency and cost. And a lot of the whole process is streamlined. And then in terms of patient outcome, certainly the planning software has shown us that sometimes we may have been about to do something that wasn't going to work so well by using just limited 2D analysis, because there are two main types of shoulder replacement. There's what we call an anatomic shoulder replacement. So you put the ball and socket the normal way around, like in a native shoulder. And there's something called a reverse shoulder replacement, where in certain situations, usually because the socket of the shoulder is too worn or because tendons are damaged, that you actually have to put the ball and socket on the other way around. And sometimes there are cases where, unless you had the planning software, you might have thought that the regular anatomic shoulder replacement was going to work for that patient. And then you run through the really detailed 3D patient-specific planning and realize, no, there's actually not enough bone there to properly support that. We may have had a bad outcome had we done what we were going to do. The software has shown us we need to do something different. So that's really, I think, one of the biggest changes in the past, say, 7 or 8 years for us, is being more accurate about our indications and our execution. And then the execution part has now just recently been taken to a new level. Because it's all very well to plan everything and have this software showing you exactly what to do, but then how do you make sure that that's what you really do when you get into the operating theater? The guide, the 3D printed guide, which is sort of an optional extra on the software, we would use it not necessarily for every case, probably for just the more complex cases because it adds cost. That's one way to make sure that you do execute your plan. But there are many more aspects to the plan. And so the latest advance with this is using augmented reality technology to actually have your plan as a hologram in front of you while you're operating, by the fact that the surgeon is wearing virtual reality goggles, essentially, a Microsoft HoloLens. And that means that as the surgeon, you can actually take in 3D the images generated from your planning and hold them next to the real operative field. And that has huge advantages because we can't always see everything. There are certain things in the field of view that we don't see very well when we're operating just because of the body and anatomy. And then you can see holographically the things that are harder to see when you're real life operating. And so the mixture of the real view and the virtual reality view right next to each other gives you so much more ability to be accurate about what you're doing and to actually execute your plan in real life.
This sounds like, you know, the Jetsons, the operating theatre. It's incredible to think that this is happening. And here in Ireland as well, it sounds so futuristic. But then, as you said, this is something that is being utilised. Does the planning and the use of VR enable surgeons to, you know, troubleshoot or work out a few different game plans before they ever touch the patient? And has it been beneficial in that regard?
Absolutely. I think, you know, we're really fortunate to have access to this technology in Ireland. This particular technology is on what's called limited user release right now. So Beacon Hospital is one of the first in Europe and one of only a really small number of centres worldwide that has done this so far with shoulder replacements and performed them using the mixed reality technology. The planning absolutely helps us to troubleshoot. So before we ever get in the operating theatre, we've already identified potential problems and being able to actually compare different solutions. So the software allows you to put different plans side by side and even to simulate the movement of the shoulder after the shoulder replacement. So you can figure out beforehand which of the potential combinations of implants or possibly bone graft will work best in that particular patient. I think when you have the mixed reality layer added to that, it allows you to go back to that plan very easily. Before we had mixed reality, so before just this past few weeks, the plan would be something that we had printed out and stuck up on the wall, and I could walk over to it and reference it during the operation, but I couldn't, you know, manipulate it and scroll through the CT in 3D and look at the implants and say, okay, how exactly did I want to place this, and, you know, which parts were the key steps that were potentially in an individual patient going to be the most challenging ones. So I think the combination of the planning and the mixed reality allows you not only to anticipate problems and troubleshoot them, but also to have that plan right in front of you in 3D when you're executing it.
Does that mean that you're spending more time, and I don't know if this was the case beforehand, but that you are spending more time pre-surgery mapping out all these scenarios, or would it have always been the same amount of time just using different tools?
It probably does mean that the surgeon spends a bit more time preoperatively mapping out the plans. We would have always spent time looking at the patient's CT before surgery and manually trying to make some measurements of basically the angles of the shoulder socket, something that we call version, and the inclination of it, which is another angle in a different plane. And it was quite crude because we were doing that on 2D CTs and manually measuring it. So if I measure those points and then you take the same CT and you measure points and angles, we're probably not going to come out with the exact same measures because there's human error. I think when you first adopt the planning software, you probably do end up spending a bit more time with it. As you get more facile with the software, it's probably as quick as when we used to try to do it manually, and you're getting so much more information because the software analyzes infinite points on the scapula, on the shoulder blade bone where the shoulder socket is part of. So you get a more accurate picture. And I think it's no harm that the surgeon has this kind of built-in almost reflex then that they spend some time with the case before going to the operating theatre, because it makes you think a bit more about that case and about that patient. And as I said, you can sometimes discover things that you wouldn't have realised if you hadn't put the CT through the planning software. And from the patient's point of view, we always would have gotten a CT scan anyway, even before we had the software. So it's nothing different for the patient. The CT is done according to the protocol that the software needs, which isn't much different than a standard shoulder CT. And then the rest of it takes place on the computer with the surgeon. So the patient doesn't actually have to go through anything extra or different in order to allow the planning to happen. And the same for the mixed reality. From the patient's point of view, the surgeon's the surgery still happens in the exact same way. And what was interesting to me about the idea of wearing a HoloLens when operating, I wondered whether, you know, it might be distracting, it might obstruct the viewer, it might somehow compromise my concentration or my ability to do what I would normally do. And I was pleasantly surprised that that was absolutely not the case. They've done a good job with even just how light the headset is, how easy it is to use, how the virtual reality sort of gestures are very easy to get used to. And so it didn't in any way take away from what I would normally do. I mean, I was ready to just take the headset off and continue the operation without the mixed reality for those first couple of cases that we did. But actually, it was not something that at all impeded me. It was something that absolutely was helping and giving me an advantage, to the point where I did a case recently where we didn't have it and I missed it. I actually really wanted that ability to be able to see my CT in 3D in front of me. So it's amazing how quickly as a surgeon you get used to having something like this. So I think it is definitely enhancing what we're doing.
Yeah, and the fact that you said that you missed it, it's not just a gimmick or a gadget, just like a little toy that is just there, that there's obviously a benefit to it, a clear benefit to it. In terms of communicating this new way of doing things to patients, you know, how is that going down? Are people open to it? Do they understand it? How much information do patients need to know about the tools that the surgeon will be using, whether they are, in air quotes, traditional or the new techie ones?
Yeah, I always explain to the patient, first of all, why I'm sending them to get the CT scan. And I explain to them that we're going to do their operation on the computer before we do it in real life. And I've never met a patient who wasn't actually quite happy about that and interested in it. They feel that, you know, the more information my surgeon has, the better a job they can do for me. So they're quite excited about it. And it's interesting because sometimes with CT scans, there can be a cost to the patient depending on insurance situations and different hospitals. And the patients have never actually had any problem with that. You know, patients always say, you know, I want my surgeon to have all of the information. In terms of the next level of it, the mixed reality level, the first patients, there were two patients on the first day that we used this technology, and both were really excited about this. The idea that this was something new that could enhance the surgeon's accuracy was something that they were really positive about. So I do explain to the patients what I'm doing. I think that's an important part of the trust between a surgeon and a patient, is that, you know, this is what's going to happen while you're asleep, and this is how I like to do it, and this is what helps me do the best possible job for you. And I think in terms of, you know, from the patient perspective, it's really important for surgeons to always apply critical introspection and over time measure the outcomes of what we're doing. And when we do that, we realize that we can always do better. You know, you could just say, well, oh, you know, it was grand the way we were doing it, right? You know, shoulder replacements had good outcomes when we didn't bother with 3D planning and, you know, when we didn't have mixed reality. But there are always things that can be tweaked and that can be better, particularly for the more complicated cases. And I think, you know, when you think about sort of diffusion of innovation models, you know, you have those early adopters and an early majority. And we're kind of right at that early phase of that curve on the left-hand side, where you've got innovators and early adopters. And we're probably somewhere between the innovator and early adopter phase with the mixed reality part of this. But I think it's our patients deserve that we are always looking for things that will make us better and try to translate that into better outcomes for them in the long term, rather than just sitting still and doing things the way they've always been done.
This is obviously a massive leap forward in terms of technology, but also, as you've described over the last 15 minutes or so, innovation and efficiencies within the entire process. We've been hearing an awful lot in recent times, recent years, in fact, about our health service and how we need to be more efficient and work smarter. Do you envisage technology continuing to play an important role and continuing to innovate within the different fields? I know that you have your particular specialty, but can you see the opportunity for this type of technology in different aspects of healthcare in Ireland?
Absolutely. I believe it has already been used in some areas like neurosurgery. There are applications of it, you know, for tumor surgery, for other areas of orthopedics. You know, the same principles that we're using in the shoulder would apply to other joints like hips and knees. It just so happens that the company which developed the planning software on which this is all based was primarily a shoulder company. And the nice thing about this technology is that, unlike some other things that have come in recent years, like navigation and things like that, this doesn't really require a huge amount of equipment or capital investment for, you know, big I suppose, computers and pieces of equipment, you know, it's just the only additional thing is the HoloLens. And so it should be something that it's not difficult to adopt. It also has a role, the virtual reality side of things has a role in training orthopedic surgeons, for example. And I know that that's something that has started to come in orthopedics in Ireland as well as elsewhere, where you can train the trainee surgeons using virtual reality and walk them through operations and have them do the operations virtually before they actually do them for the first time in real life. So I think there are huge applications both in the training and education part of healthcare and in the actual patient care delivery aspect.
That was Ruth Delaney, consultant orthopaedic surgeon based out of the Beacon Hospital here in Dublin. And that is all we have time for this week. If you missed any of the show, you can listen back in full on the News Talk app powered by Go Loud. A quick reminder that you should check out the Technology on the Pat Kenny Show podcast as well. You can hit subscribe while you're in the News Talk app to make sure you get the latest reviews that we put up each and every week. John Friday's up next here on News Talk. I'll chat to you next week.